This is Taking Care in Business, a podcast that dives into the topic of corporate social responsibility from many different perspectives. Host Vicki Bolson is the founder and CEO of Bolson Group, a unified marketing company located in Indianapolis. Bolson Group is the first B Corp certified company in Indiana, but Vicki understands that you don't have to be certified in corporate social responsibility in order to use business as a force for good. Join Vicki as she talks about why it's always worthwhile to take care in business.
Hey, Sawyer, how you doing?
Oh, doing great. How are you?
I am good. I'm good. It's good to be back. We've taken a little bit of a break.
Oh, yeah. It's been nice to rest and recharge the batteries a little bit. So
I know. It's so weird. Summer coming to an end and going into fall. Mm-hmm. I don't know, though. Fall is my favorite season. What about you?
Yeah, I really enjoy fall, but it's always kind of sad when summer ends because, you know, it's getting back to the normal grind or the rest of the year.
Yeah.
But fall's always nice because football's back. So,
yeah, I think as I get older, I'm realizing that summer is not my favorite season.
Yeah,
the heat just don't know.
Mm-hmm.
It used to be my favorite, you know, especially when I was your age because you had the break, but not so much anymore. So I am excited to be back, and we have a great guest today. I feel like I have a kinship with him. And I'm excited to sort of hear a little bit more of the background about what makes Andy Dix tick. But today we have Andy Dix, and I am super excited about him. He is a consultant coach. But he has a really unique background to arriving to that. And he has his own podcast called Hopeful Hoosier. I've actually been a guest on it, and I loved when I was a guest on his podcast. I think it was my favorite interview I've done, not interview I have done with someone, but interview that I've been interviewed. He just really pulled a lot out of me. And afterwards I thought, I really did say that, didn't I? And it was just kind of nice to put thoughts into words and kind of own it. So he's a very good interviewer. And just an all-around great person. Everybody who knows him just oohs and ahs about him. And so welcome, Andy.
Well, thank you, Vicki, and great to be with you, Sawyer. What a great introduction. You know, it's always weird to be on this side of the conversation and not have to have my questions in mind and all that. So I'll do my best to behave and not try to interview you again. So, but I did enjoy interviewing you as well. So.
Yeah, like I said, I feel like we have a little bit of a kinship with having podcasts that are definitely not the same topic, but have some similarities. In fact, you on and off air gave me some ideas for people I should talk to that were doing cool things and that would be a great fit. And so I really appreciate that. But I am just mostly excited to talk to you today because I want to hear a couple of things. I want to hear the journey from having worked at Comcast Spotlight and then going into this coaching that you do. And then I also want to hear the journey of deciding to do the podcast. So I don't know which one you want to talk about first. Maybe one sort of, you know, is a good segue into the other question.
Yeah. So I was very, very fortunate to spend 17 wonderful years through the rapid growth of cable and internet advertising with the folks at NBC Universal Comcast. The division I supported was Comcast Spotlight, the advertising division. And I was based here in Indianapolis, but I covered multiple states and multiple cities and multiple support teams. And it was really an interesting and wonderful journey. Towards the end, the last 7 years or so, I was actually a performance improvement consultant as we were looking for ways to continue to increase the ability to perform at a very high level on a revenue side, but also to meet the expectations of our clients as the advertising environment and landscape continued to rapidly change. And through that, we actually retooled my team to become coaches for sales leaders and for senior sales executives. And it was just a really exciting transformational time to completely stop what you were doing and learn a new skill. And so we started that process. And one day I was thinking that we were going to be walking into a promotion where the program I had been piloting was going to be taken nationwide. And instead, I walked out with a severance package because the world had changed and the organizational needs had changed. And it was a very gracious severance package, which I am eternally thankful for. But I found myself in my 50s saying, well, what's next? And the kind people at Comcast had put me in touch with folks at an outplacement service, and I went through the classes, and I was really surprised at how short the duration of most senior executives is now. It's around 24 months. And so that's really just sort of a project, you know, and I really didn't like the alternative of being in a corporate role and then having to do a job search again and again and again, you know, because I still figured I had about 15 years to run before I could retire, whatever that means. And so I said, well, one of the options they suggested was starting your own business. And I was really excited about coaching and had thought that that would be a great sort of twilight career down the road. So I just accelerated that and started my own company, AD Growth Advisors. And that was now 5 years ago already, which is just crazy. Through that and becoming a board certified executive coach, I started to realize that I needed to increase my local connections and network, because while I was based here, I was never here in Indianapolis. And I got connected just sort of by chance through a co-working space that I was working at with some amazing people, Harrison Painter, Josh Bach here in Indianapolis. And they were doing something called Amplify Indy. And it was about building community and building relationships, not just on a business standpoint, but a personal standpoint. And they were doing some really neat projects. Like they took 50 nonprofit startups, put them in a room, and over the course of a year provided training and support and development so that if these nonprofit startups wanted to, they could walk out of the program a year later as a 501c3 nonprofit with a fully developed board and things like that. And through that process, I supported some training and different things. But my goodness, there were so many amazing people who I had never heard of in, you know, Indianapolis doing wonderful things. One of my friends now, he is a garbage man by trade and supports garbage pickup at construction sites. But his real job that he loves the most, he has a nonprofit called Heart in Hands. And what he does is he and his family cook hot meals for who he calls his friends. Most of us call them homeless in downtown Indianapolis. And every weekend, they spend their own time and money and they support feeding the homeless here in Indianapolis. About 150 hot meals every weekend. And it's just a labor of love. And, you know, it humbled me and awed me to meet him. And he was just one. Tag is his he goes by Tag. And that's just one story out of 50 that were amazing. Another woman that was just dedicated to making sure that mothers in the inner city had diapers for their kids so they could go to daycare. One woman in Indianapolis has dedicated her life to making sure that people and families of incarcerated people here in the state can get transportation to go visit their loved one while they're incarcerated. And it was just an incredible experience. And I said over and over again to Harrison and Josh Bach, I said, these are amazing stories. These are amazing people. Why don't I know about them? And because they make a difference, they don't make headlines. And so I was just kind of asking that question one day, and Josh and Harrison both did a number of different podcasts. They said, well, you have a radio background. Why aren't you doing your podcast? Mm. And I didn't have a good answer other than I was too lazy to do it. And I said, well, maybe you're right. And one day it just dawned on me that what I was really seeing in the headlines was that we're suffering from what I call a crisis of hope. And by hope, I don't mean just wishful thinking. I mean that we envision a better and brighter future. And then we are so enamored with that vision that we start taking positive steps in action to make it a reality. And so they call it in the folks that study hope, they call it willpower and way power. So where there's a will, there's a way kind of thing that creates hope. Mm-hmm. And I just said, wow, you know, in being with these other people that are doing their part to make their difference, it just inspired me. It made me hopeful that, you know, there's going to be a future for my adult daughters long after I'm gone and for grandkids, et cetera. And that's where the Hopeful Hoosier was born. I decided, why not interview amazing people doing very terrific things that are the unsung heroes here in the state of Indiana and share their stories? So it's hyper local. It's a labor of love on my part. And it's all about telling stories about people who have sort of found a problem that for whatever reason has their name written on it. Mm-hmm. And they have to do something. They may not solve it, but they're going to try to certainly influence it in a positive way. And that's where we are. So I think it's now episode 22 or so. And it's just, it's a joy to meet amazing people and to be able to have a conversation. I try to do them on location. So it may be in a coffee shop, it may be in an office space, wherever. But to hear them firsthand share that story of making their difference and, of course, hopefully challenging the listener to figure out what problems got their name on it and what should they be doing to make a positive difference as well.
Yeah. Wow. That's you did such a good job of answering both at the same time of my questions. I think what's interesting is that, you know, you faced a pretty challenging time to have been given severance after 17 years and you remained hopeful, you know, and forged a new way and a new path. And, you know, especially with someone in their 50s, you know, when that happens, you know, you go through those. I hear this all the time from my friends, these emotions of, am I too old? Is anybody going to hire me? You know, am I not relevant anymore? Did you go through some of those feelings too?
Go through on a daily basis. You know, it challenges when your whole world is completely sort of ripped up, and then the narrative and the script and the trajectory is stopped, and you find yourself just in the course of one conversation and one day later, looking at a blank canvas. What do I do? Where do I go from here? You know, who am I at this point? And more importantly, who do I really want to be? And in this next act of my career, I was fortunate. It's very unusual for people to have as long a run in one particular career and to get to do the things and experiences that I was able to do. But at the same time, you know, it questions your identity. You're not just what you do, you're who you are. Mm-hmm. It certainly was a financial setback of enormous proportions. And yet at the same time, you look at it and you say, well, am I going to be bitter or am I going to be better? Because there's a chance here to make that, I'm at that crossroads. I can be bitter and say, life's not fair and poor me, or I can be better and say, there's an opportunity of a lifetime to do what I always wanted to do, whatever that is, and to figure that out and to continue to grow, because grow is the surest form of life. You know, if you're growing, you're alive. And that's sort of where I found myself. And so one day after another, over the course of the last 5 years, and Vicki, you know, you run a small business. I just have to pick up that challenge and say, is this what I want to do? And as long as the benefits and the opportunities to have positive impact, to at least cover the financial aspects of living that are important to me, and to make a positive difference are there, then, you know, this sort of seems like such an important course to stay on at this point.
Mm-hmm. Well, you gave all kinds of advice in that answer. I was going to ask you, what kind of advice would you give someone who found themselves in that position? But I heard a lot of advice. Is there anything you'd like to add to that?
Well, I think the biggest thing is, this is not a time to be alone. And it's, you feel like a failure. You feel like you're no longer wanted. You feel like you've been cast aside or thrown away, so to speak. And that's not the case. It really is just business, and the business world is changing. In fact, I advise my clients that the most challenging and precarious position to be in Indiana is a W-2 employee, because we're an at-will state. So, you know, at any given time, for any given reason, you can be transitioned out and not have the golden parachute that I had. And so I like the idea of having a little bit of more influence over my destiny. And I think that's the thing when you look at it, what different revenue streams or opportunities to serve and add value are available to you, and to develop multiple streams so that you're not at real risk of one conversation completely sinking your whole existence, you know? So I think that's important. But the other thing is, don't be alone. Find support groups. There are wonderful support groups out there. There are coaches. There are all sorts of resources, networking groups, et cetera, and participate, be visible. And if worst comes to worst, the thing that I think is so important is to find a way and a reason to get up and add some value every day. So, you know, funny story on my part, we belong to East 91st Street Christian Church, a large church on the north side of Indianapolis. And one of the things that they needed was a security officer in the evenings. And I had never done security per se as an executive, it was a way to serve. It was a way to make a little bit of money to feel like I was contributing to the family again. And it got me up and got me going. And I did that for a couple of years, actually. And that taught me a lot of really interesting lessons and insights. And I don't regret a single minute of it. And as my business grew, then I was able to transition out of that and now, you know, do the executive coaching full time. But I think the thing is, even if you have to volunteer, it just reinforces to yourself that you are valuable. It's not what you do, it's who you are and what you can contribute. And there are certain things that only you can uniquely contribute in any situation. And if you just take that challenge up, then you suddenly don't feel so bad for yourself because you're helping other people and you see that you can make a difference.
I love that. That's really great advice. I mentioned to you before we started recording that I have an adult child who is trying to figure out post-college where to live. Do I go to grad school? Do I get a job? Whatever. And I shared with her, I had listened to a podcast episode, Anna Faris. She has a podcast called Unqualified. I don't know if you've heard of it, but she interviews mostly well-known people, celebrities, be it actors or singers or whatever. And she did one with, oh gosh, I can't believe I can't think of her name right now, but one of the judges from Chopped, which is a show on HGTV. And I had never really thought about it, but like, what makes you be positioned for a job being a judge on Chopped? You know? And so she was, Anna Faris was asking her, like, how did you arrive in this, you know, job? And she was talking about how, well, I graduated from a liberal arts college with an English degree. And I'm like, okay, that's my daughter. And she's like, you know, I'm thinking the world is my oyster, but it's also a little, you know, she said, didn't know what to do with it. And somebody, a coach, someone like yourself, Andy, told her to list, you know, her, what she likes to do, what she's good at. And then when she did, she said, look at this, you've got all kinds of talents. And, you know, a lot of people can't even do that. And so she had listed like cooking and traveling and writing. And so if now you can see how, cause she ended up, she's also a travel writer. Mm-hmm. And she just took this, she thought, oh my gosh, like I can do what I like and get paid for doing it. So I pretty much what you just said is to sort of assess and evaluate like what you have to contribute and give, and then make a career of it. Because I mean, with your coaching, and I want to segue to that because I want to hear a little bit about impact or trends and what you are finding to be sort of the hot buttons on the people you coach? Like, are they, why are they coming to you? You know, does it have to do with trying to find more peace and happiness in their job positions?
Well, before we get into that, I want to just advise, because your daughter was very lucky. She found somebody that was able to help them. And so for the listener who may be able to relate, I want to recommend a terrific book that I honestly had never heard of. It's been out for a while. Some people, when I share it, have said, oh, yeah. But it's really good. And it's called Designing Your Life. And it's by William Burnett and David J. Evans. And they have a unique approach because they take design thinking and apply it to life development. And I love it. They also have another follow-up book called Designing Your Life at Work, or Designing Your Work Life. And that's also a great book as well. But their exercises are simple. They're doable for anyone. And it helps you understand where, and I don't like to use the word control because we have so little control in life, but where you have influence and where you can guide your life into something that really is what you envision your ideal future to look like over time. And it may not be a straight line. It's going to be a zigzag curvy line. But I love their approach of designing that life. And one of the things, just real quickly, they advise, which I think is spot on, is when you're at these crossroads and trying to decide which way to go, don't just model out one version of a potential reality. They advise modeling out three. And there's some real good psychology there, because when you model out three what ifs, you can start to see what's similar, what's different, what really matters in those. Mm-hmm. And you may end up a fourth place or a sixth place down the road, but it just lets you keep in mind that you have more options than you may intuitively think about. And when you have that open mindset that there's a lot of new options and that serendipity may just place an option that I wasn't even thinking about, you're more willing to say yes and experiment and take some chances that actually lead you someplace better than you could even imagine.
I love that. I'm going to get that book for her, maybe both of them, the Designing Your Life and Designing Your Work Life, especially if there's exercises in there.
Yes.
One thing that I was told by someone was to visualize, this kind of plays off of the three or six options or whatever that you have, is to visualize the options, like what life would be like living in that, you know, going to work, coming home, what family, how do you integrate family into that? And I love that advice, because as I am making decisions of any sort, I do a lot of visualization, like just seeing like, what does this look like? And can I see myself in it? You know, even the simple things like only driving to, because we're in a COBRID working space now, or did I just say COBRID? A co-working hybrid. That, hey, I have a new term, COBRID. But I imagined before I committed to that and we left our office, can I visualize that being the case? Instead of driving downtown every day, can I imagine working from home most days and then driving there occasionally? And it really helps.
Yeah. And Vicki, I totally agree. And I, as coaches, you know, we're trained to help people visualize, create vision boards, all those kinds of things. Here's the interesting thing about that, that it's all about timing in some cases. Case Western Reserve has done some really terrific research using fMRI studies. And what they found is when we feel insecure, when we're in that mindset of where we feel we're at risk or where we're defensive, then our creative aspects, the parts of our brain that fuel the neural networks for creativity, go offline. And so when you've experienced this big trauma and life change, the best way I could describe it was the screen for the future went blank in my head and I couldn't call it up. I couldn't visualize what the future would look like because I was so out of sorts and so defensive in such a mental state. And it took almost probably 2.5 years. before I felt secure enough in what the path I had kind of started stumbling and wandering down, that suddenly was able to come back online. And I was able to start envisioning what could a future look like? What are the possibilities here? And in working with my own coach, we were able to do that. But I tell you, it was the oddest experience in my life, because I couldn't see forward. It was like being in a severe San Francisco fog trying to drive, and I could only see maybe an hour or two in the future. And my coach was able to be walking alongside of me through that, and I was able to lean on their visioning and let them describe some possibilities that helped me sort of say, yeah, that's probably it. No, that's not quite it. So if you're having trouble, the first thing to do is figure out, you know, am I insecure here? Meaning I don't feel safe. I doubt myself. I've got all these kind of negative thinking going on. And until we can resolve that, it may be really hard to be creative. And that's natural. It's normal. It's a part of the human healing process.
Yeah. Well, I think that what you're describing is for a person who has gone through or is going through a, like, what's next in my life. But mm-hmm. as a coach, I'm sure you have these same conversations with someone who is employed, and they are employed at a place yeah. that they think is their dream job, but they're struggling. Or so, and I gathered from, you know, sleuthing on you a little bit that you go into companies and you help executives that are employed, you know, so talk a little bit about that and what the difference is of getting out of a funk when you're in what you think is your dream job.
Yeah, I think the thing that the book that I've recommended they talk about is the job you're in good enough for now? And that doesn't mean it's forever, because as I said earlier, you know, a lot of jobs are only going to be 24-month jobs. And by the way, that includes CEOs. That's how rapidly our world is changing.
Wow.
And so is it good enough for now? Meaning, do I have enough opportunity to learn, grow, or change, or develop relationships that even if the job itself is disappointing or frustrating, or my boss is a real jerk or whatever, are there other aspects of it that are real opportunities and pathways to whatever life is taking me to next? And if you reframe your mindset to have that idea that this isn't forever, I know it's not forever, it's for now, and it's okay for now. That means it doesn't have to be great, it doesn't have to be wonderful, but I can accept what it is, you know, as objectively as we can, and know that I can be sort of guiding myself towards something that is more life-giving and something that I want. So when I work with executives in my practice, my primary field of expertise is in the realm of what we call motivational intelligence. And that is helping people understand what matters most to them, what drives their habits and behaviors, what creates their value system and influences how they see their world and create their unique worldview. It also is a big insight into what's going to cause frustration, and also where are we most likely to misunderstand other people and have conflict with them. And so what we do is help executives see how does their unique value system, the way they naturally see the world, compare to other people. And a lot of times senior leaders are very surprised when we can statistically say, look, when it comes to your sense of right and wrong, you are the top 1% of the population in North America. So you see things naturally very black or white with very little gray area, but compared to most other people, that's really rare. It's much more important to you and is going to generate a much greater sensitivity and a much greater sense of frustration or satisfaction and a need to act on that than most other people. And why that's important is the biggest mistake executives make, in my opinion, is they try to naturally be the boss that they need themselves to everybody else. And that's a little bit like giving a Christmas gift that I'd like to receive to Vicky. Now, it's not going to fit too well, and it's not going to be perfect, right? And so it's not the thought that counts. It's actually in the delivery. And so bosses and executives have to understand how to be chameleons. And even if it uses a lot of self-control and willpower to delay gratification of our own needs, we allow people the ability and the environment to thrive and to meet their own needs. And it takes a lot of motivational intelligence to go past that, because naturally what we do is discount or divide on these value differences. So opposites don't attract, they're motivated to argue. And if somebody is very orderly and they're the boss, they think that everybody should be orderly and everything should be in its place. Well, if somebody's the opposite of that and very spontaneous, they need a certain amount of clutter and mess to create a stimulating environment where they feel comfortable. If it's too structured and orderly, they have to use the precious amount of willpower and self-control they have every day, because it's refreshed when we sleep, to try to fit in. And they're fighting their nature and using bandwidth in their brain, and they're using all of this self-control that they may need later just to fit in. So what we want to do is craft environments through understanding and tolerance and acceptance that are truly inclusive of all of our differences, so they don't divide us. We can actually then get a complete worldview. Like I like to say, you know, it's like a mosaic. A mosaic maker takes these very sharp and odd-shaped pieces that are beautiful in their own right and places them in proximity to other sharp and odd-shaped pieces, and they hold them together with grout. In an organization, the grout is understanding, it's tolerance, it's acceptance, it's respect. It's all of these values that we can create organizationally to hold very different people in close proximity and create this magnificent managerial mosaic that actually allows us to add a tremendous value. And that's hard to do, but it's really what inclusion is all about. Making sure that we don't just hire clones of ourselves, but we allow other people with different worldviews to share their things that they see that we can't.
Amen. Boy, that was beautifully said. I love the mosaic, what do you call that metaphor too, because I loved a mosaic tile. Mm-hmm. And now as I'm doing that, I'm going to be thinking of what you said. That is such a great way of describing that. Well, when you said motivational intelligence, I wrote that down, and then I underneath it I wrote emotional intelligence, because I was going to ask you, do you find that it varies with an executive, that, you know, on their emotional intelligence level?
Yeah, and I'm not knocking Daniel Goleman's work and all that. It's just that emotional intelligence, I haven't found much you can do with it. You understand it, you know, kind of there's motions there. Yeah, okay, but what do I do with it? Motivational intelligence actually identifies 16 different desires that everyone wants in different amounts around the planet. And so when you start understanding what matters to someone, you can then act in a way that says, if it matters to you, it matters to me because you matter to me. And that person feels understood. And, you know, the old saying, seek first to understand, then be understood, is so absolutely spot on when it comes to organizational harmony and alignment. And that's what we're in. We're in this new world, especially as we work virtually and we work more and more with people who aren't employees, but are contractors or who have been outsourced and they're just a solopreneur, et cetera. How do we bring all these very different people together and harmonize them? And that's where this understanding of what matters to them and helping them see that whatever needs done is worth doing from their own value system. When you can do that, you can actually inspire people to be on board for their own reasons. And everyone's reasons are going to be different. And once a leader understands that I can't motivate anybody because all motivation is intrinsic inside of that person, then what's left? What's left is I have to understand what matters to that person. And unfortunately, we just don't come with an owner's manual. We don't have a tool that says, wow, you know, here's what matters to me. We spend a lifetime experimenting, And that's where Professor Stephen Reese from The Ohio State University about 30 years ago came out with the Reese Motivation Profile. And it's this scientifically derived instrument that allows people to really get a good sense of what matters to them, how they compare to other people in the valuation of this. And then also it becomes predictive because then they can say, how's this role going to fit my nature? How are these other people going to be a part of my work group or my team? And how are we going to get along, and where are we going to likely misunderstand each other? And that's where motivational intelligence becomes very practical and applicable in helping create alignment, harmony, and trust inside of organizations.
Yeah, that makes total sense. Wow. I could talk to you all day, I think, because I would love to be able to ask you like an impact story, you know, someone that you've come in. Why don't you tell us before we wrap, think of one impact story of someone that you have coached that you that you think is either a great example of what you do, or it's just like, hey, people, pay attention to what we just talked about, because this can really be a good thing for you.
So this is the names have been changed and everything to protect the somewhat innocent here. But I was working with a high-tech company, and the CEO was a marathon runner. And one of the 16 basic desires is for physical activity. Some of us need a whole lot of physical activity to feel normal. Some of us want almost no physical activity, and we are more motivated to pick up leisure, rest, and comfort. And we don't see the world the same way. Opposites here. Well, this marathoner CEO wanted to do a software update sprint for the app that they were creating, and it was going to be a 3-week sprint. They had a design team of 5 people, and he had just through COVID found a way to increase his performance and his creativity. It's called a treadmill desk. I don't know if you're familiar with those, you're able to walk or run and still use your computer. And so he just thought that was the key to his overall well-being, because he felt so wonderful because he was out on the West Coast, and you know, during COVID you couldn't get out and it was restricted. So here he was able to keep his runs in and all that. And he thought, wow, why don't we actually have a true sprint? And there's some software you could do and track with friends. And so he thought he would actually get these treadmill desks for all of his developers, and they would do a true sprint, and they would track how fast they were going and how far they went over the 3-week period. Well, as you can imagine, 3 of the 5 developers said they would quit, that it was awful, that he was so insensitive, and that he had no idea what he was doing. He was a tyrant. Now, why was that? Because he wasn't. He thought he was doing good. He loved it. He was making the fundamental error that we all make. He was trying to give that gift for others that he wanted himself. And so if he knew his people, what they really wanted, those 3 are very strong on comfort and leisure and hate physical activity. They wanted a comfortable chair. He could have got them a massage chair, and they would have thought that was wonderful.
That's so interesting.
That's the difference. It's understanding what the person needs and what they want, and then resourcing them appropriately. That's the key to unlocking performance.
Wow, that's so interesting. Okay, now I have to ask one more question off of that before we close. Do you find that, say, he was just so stunned that, like, you know, I can't believe it, that they'd rather have a massage chair than a treadmill desk. Is there any good in him recruiting people who think like him?
Well, and that's what that's why you notice the statistics say that a lot of hiring decisions are made in the first 30 to 40 seconds. And that's a human trait. We are tribal by nature. And so we look for commonalities. We don't pay nearly as close attention to commonalities as we do to differences, because differences trigger a primitive protective system called the limbic system, the fight, flight, or freeze mentality, friend or foe. And so if we find somebody who's very, very different motivationally from us, that just creeps us out, because in our world, it doesn't fit our value system. It doesn't fit the script of how normal people act. And so they're weird or odd. We don't want them around. But what we fail to understand at an emotional level is it's not threatening. It's just different. Different by definition means not the same. We're all not the same, but we all think we're normal. We're far from normal. But what we can do is when we can raise our motivational intelligence, we can understand our sensitivities and our triggers, but we don't have to act on them. We can use that self-control and willpower and say, wait a second, that person's really different. They see things fundamentally different from me, and that's important for me to include because I need that worldview because it is valid that I can't see. Otherwise, my mosaic has a big gap in it. And there's a big block that's missing, and the picture isn't complete. I don't have a holistic worldview. And that's the danger. So yeah, you can have the most harmonized team in the world. They all have similar values. The problem is they all have similar blind spots. And so they miss one whole element or multiple whole elements of a valid worldview. We each have our own subjective version of reality in our head. And we all think it's normal, but it's not. It's just ours. And we need for people to share their subjective version of reality. And when we combine all of them together, we have a mosaic of something that is actually closer to what we could say is truly reality. Then we can make informed decisions. So the most dangerous thing is if everybody's too alike, you know, we'll all get along fabulously well and never have any problems, and we'll all go over the cliff that none of us could see coming. And that's a problem. That's where the true magic and bonus and benefit of a diverse and inclusive environment is. Because when we include opposite values and we celebrate all those differences that really truly exist in humanity all over the world, then we have an opportunity through that unity and understanding to more accurately assess reality as it truly is.
Wow. Love it. Good stuff. Good stuff, Andy. Sawyer, I bet you learned a lot. You're a recent college grad. I'm going to have to definitely have my kids listen to this episode because it's good stuff when you're looking for a job to just all around the books that you suggested, just the thinking. I've written down a few things that might lead me to different article topics for our newsletter. So, gosh, this was great. Okay,
well, Vicki, let me share one last thing here, and that is, if you want to know the secret to the meaning of life, it's really not a secret. It's do the most of what you find most meaningful. When you do that, you're by definition going to have a meaningful life. The challenge is we end up doing things that people tell us we should do, not that we must do and want to do. And so whenever you have that thought that says, I should do this, that tells me that it's off motivational course for you because you don't have a reason that you want to do it. So you're using guilt or you're using something else that says I should. So when it's a should, we have to really rethink about it and say, is there a way to get this to a want to or a must? And if we focus on the must do it, I must do this, not because I feel guilty, because I just feel incomplete if I don't, then you're on that path that's really designed to be fulfilling. And you won't live a great life. You know, I don't believe in such a thing as living the good life, but I do believe in living well through life. And you live well when your needs are met. And that's the key, because then your frustration's low and your satisfaction's high, even through adversity and everything else. And no one can ask for any more than that.
Yeah. That's good stuff. I mean, it goes, see, I'm not stopping talking to you. It's like the whole, like, I can't remember who told me this, but instead of saying, I have to go pick up my daughter from whatever, I have to, like, to stop saying I have to, like, I'm, you know, and at first I was like, well, you do have to, they have to be picked up, but it's the intentionality of the word, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that I hear myself sometimes thinking about that when I'm saying something, like saying it in a way that can't be perceived as a negative, you know? Mm-hmm. And then if you can't change that way of saying it, then that's when you know this isn't a meaningful situation.
That's right. And we all do stuff that we don't like. That's okay. We can use self-control and willpower to do it. It's just a matter of understanding if I'm doing that 8 hours, 10 hours a day in a job, it's going to be soul sucking It's going to drain the life right out of me, and I'm going to be miserable. And a lot of times we're miserable in a role, not because the role's bad. It's just because we're a bad motivational fit for it. It doesn't fill our tank, and it's the wrong sort of fuel. Somebody else will think it's the best job in the world. We're just taking up somebody else's opportunity because we haven't found the one that's most life-giving and satisfying of our needs out there yet. And that's where, once again, the hunt, just keep looking and guiding towards where your heart's desires are taking you. Because Saint Augustine said this, and I think it's wonderful. He said, if you want to understand me, don't ask me what I believe, because what I believe is not what is important. Ask me what I love. Because we live our lives through our hearts and through our loves. I butchered that a little bit, but that's the idea. Mm-hmm. We do, our heart's desires will drive us to what we need in order to feel satisfied and fulfilled. And when we follow that, we're not going to be too far wrong.
Yeah. Okay. Good way to end. So tell everyone how they can find you in your podcast.
They can find the podcast wherever they download podcasts at the Hopeful Hoosier podcast. It's available on most platforms. And if you'd like to know more about me and what I do and how I help mainly businesses with people problems or problem people, well, you can find me at adgrowthadvisors.com.
Okay. Thank you for joining us, Andy. It was wonderful.
As always, Vicki, it's just a joy, and I wish you all the best of success. And Sawyer, same to you. Thanks for having me and letting me share my story.
I just want to thank Sawyer Benj, our producer, and our show sponsors, Selflessly in Charge. If you'd like to nominate someone for Taking Care in Community, you can visit our website, takingcareinbusiness.com, or email us at info@takingcareinbusiness.com. Don't forget to subscribe, follow, or download Taking Care in Business wherever you get your podcasts. If you love Taking Care in Business, give us a 5-star rating and leave a review or share this episode on your social media. We're on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at Taking Care in Biz. That's Taking Care in Biz, B-I-Z. If you have questions or comments, you can also email us at info@takingcareinbusiness.com. Thank you for joining us today. Thanks to our sponsors, Selflessly in Charge. And until next time, take care in business.